known as the quantum circuit model. So that's what I'm going to describe over the next few view graphs. When people talk about quantum computers, what they typically mean is a quantum circuit. Deutsch originally worked with so-called quantum Turing machines, and they're equivalent to this quantum circuit model, which I'm about to describe. I'll describe it in parallel with the classical circuit model. Basically, what a quantum computer looks like is very, very similar to a classical computer. You have a classical computer is made up of a whole bunch of bits, maybe represented by voltages in an electric circuit. In a quantum computer, you have qubits, which are represented by as yet unknown physical systems. We haven't been able to build quantum computers yet. And the very first thing is you prepare some sort of an input state to your computer in both cases, a qubit or bit input state. In the classical case, you then do a whole bunch of logical operations on the bits making up your computer. In the quantum case, well, you know, you can't do quite the same set of logical operations because, as I've already mentioned, you're constrained to do unitary operations on your on the qubits in your computer, and unitary operations, it turns out, are reversible. The reason why that is because the inverse of a unitary matrix is also a unitary matrix. So given the output from a quantum logic gate, you can, in principle, infer what the input was. And that's not the case for all classical logic gates. Consider, for example, the AND gate. You know, 0, 0 input to an AND gate gives the value 0, but also 0, 1 input to an AND gate gives the output 0. So it's not possible to infer what the input was. We say that the AND gate is not reversible or is irreversible. And that's not a property which quantum logic gates have. So there are some additional constraints in the quantum case, but there's also an expanded space of possibilities because the space of quantum states is so much larger than the space of classical logic states. And finally, the third step, which seems rather trivial in the classical case, you look at your computer and determine what the output is. Of course, in the quantum case, we know that's not so trivial. You can't completely read out the state of the computer. You can only obtain partial information. So in designing quantum algorithms, you have to be sure that you are able to obtain the information that you desire from the final state of the computer. Let me describe each of these elements in slightly more detail. We've already seen most of them in the last talk. I'll just re-mention the Pauli gates as example of single-qubit quantum logic gates. So those are these three guys here, which I wrote down in the last talk. A couple more interesting single-qubit gates. One is the so-called Hadamard gate. So it's a single-qubit gate. And what it does is when you take 0 as input, it gives you the equal superposition of 0 and 1 as output with this normalization factor of root 2. And when it takes 1 as input, it gives you 0 minus 1 over root 2. And you can write that out in this matrix form and go off and check that it's unitary with a few minutes work. Another interesting gate is the so-called phase gate. The phase gate actually does very little to a qubit. It does nothing at all to the zero state, and to the one state, all it does is apply this phase factor of I. In fact, it's very similar to the Z gate. You'll notice that if I was to apply the phase gate twice, it would be the same as applying the Z gate. The reason I'm going through this particular set of gates now, the Hadamard gate and the phase gate, is I'm going to take those two gates, I'm going to add a couple of multi-qubit gates, and then argue that they form sort of a complete set. Any quantum computation whatsoever can be decomposed in terms of those operations alone. So in some sense, they're all you need to know about to understand quantum computation. So those are the two single-qubit gates that we're going to need. We're also going to need some multi-qubit gates. The first of these is the so-called controlled not gate. It's it's essentially a classical gate. You have two qubits, a control qubit, and a target qubit. I'll assume they start in computational basis states C and T. And the controlled not gate does nothing at all to the control qubit. It leaves it alone, but it flips the target qubit if the control is set. And if you write this out as a 4x4 unitary matrix, the corresponding transformation, you'll find that this is what you get, and you can easily go away and verify that this is in fact a unitary matrix, and thus represents a valid dynamics for some quantum systems. And people have been able to show that in specific quantum systems you can actually perform a transformation very much like this one. In fact, in some systems they've done exactly this, up to noise. The other multi-qubit gate which we'll need is the Toffoli gate. It's very similar again to the controlled NOT gate. The only difference is that rather than having a single control bit, we now have two control bits, control bit 1 and control bit 2, and a target bit, T. The control bits, again, are left alone, and the target is flipped whenever both control bits are set to 1. And if they're not both set to 1, then it's not flipped. I should mention, by the way, that this addition symbol here is addition modulo 2. Okay, so that's the Toffoli gate and the control NOT gate. Those are the only two multi-qubit gates we're going to need. Actually, physicists might be a little bit worried by the Toffoli gate. In general, most bodies in nature don't interact in a three-body sort of a fashion. We tend to get two-body interactions. You'll be pleased to know that, in fact, the Toffoli gate is not essential here. What you can do is that library of single-qubit gates, which I described to you before, you can add one extra single-qubit gate. I won't describe exactly which one, but you can just add an extra single-qubit gate. And then, so those gates from before, these two, plus that extra gate, the so-called pi of 8 gate, plus the controlled NOT gate, those gates together would also form a universal set for quantum computation. But I'm going to need the Toffoli gate later on, so I thought I'd work with this particular set. All right, basically we're done in terms of quantum computation. I just want to say what I mean by universality exactly. Suppose we have an arbitrary unitary transformation now on n qubits. What it means that that set of logic gates is universal for computation is that you can be approximated arbitrarily well by a sequence of Hadamard gates, phase gates, controlled NOT gates, and Toffoli gates. And in particular, any quantum computation whatsoever can always be broken down in terms of these fundamental gates. So that's all a quantum computer is. You've got a bunch of qubits, and then you just apply a circuit containing Hadamard gates, phase gates, controlled NOT, and Toffoli gates. Or you can pick some other universal set. It doesn't matter which particular set of gates you use, because given some other set, you can simulate it using these gates efficiently. Let me just mention one little side point, which I'm not going to say too much about because other people will say a lot more about it later in the week. One reason why I chose this particular set of gates has to do with noise. It's certainly going to be the case that noise is going to be a dreadful problem in quantum computers. In fact, at the present time, in most quantum systems, noise is pretty much all we can see. Now we're gradually getting to the point where the control of the system is much better and the effects of noise are being greatly reduced. That's been a big trend really for the last 30 or 35 years, especially in quantum optics. But noise will certainly be a problem for a long time to come. And what you'd like to do is to develop some sort of method for error correction to reduce the effects of noise on your quantum computer. And people have devoted a great deal of effort over the past few years into developing methods for doing quantum computation fault tolerantly, meaning in a way that can tolerate the effects of noise. And it turns out that some particular sets of gates are much easier than other sets of gates to perform in a fault tolerant fashion. This particular set, which I've chosen, has perhaps the simplest fault tolerant implementation. And Manny Cannell is going to describe a whole lot more about fault tolerant computation later in the week. He's giving two lectures on the subject. Okay, so let's just summarize the quantum circuit model. I'm going to mention a few conventions which people tend to use in the quantum computing community. Really, there's three steps to a quantum computation. We usually start out in the state consisting of n qubits, all initialized in the zero state. Sometimes people use different conventions. They don't necessarily start in this state, but it's certainly polite to advise when that's not the case. I should mention there's an interesting open problem. Certainly if you start in any computational basis state, it doesn't change the power of the quantum circuit model. problem which I find very interesting and intriguing is what would happen if you were able to start with maybe some much more complicated state. It's usually assumed that that's not possible, but in some physical systems you actually get very complicated states arising naturally in that system, and might it be possible to exploit that to get additional computational power above and beyond the quantum circuit model. But yeah, for the purposes of the quantum circuit model as is currently understood, we always start in this state. Then we apply some circuit consisting of our universal set of gates, and at the end of the day we perform a measurement, we perform a measurement in the computational basis to read out the information, or to read out the final state of the computer, and we infer the result of our quantum computation from that. So that's all I mean by the quantum circuit model. Now I'm going to give a couple of examples of the quantum circuit model in action. The first is the example of superdense coding. Superdense coding involves two parties, Alice and Bob. And it's actually a communication protocol, not a computation, but I'm going to present it as a computation because you can do it that way, and it's a nice and easy example of the quantum circuit model in action. What's the basic problem here? The basic problem is that Alice has in her possession two bits of classical information. So A is a classical bit and B is a classical bit, 0 or 1. What she'd like to do is transmit that information over to Bob. And in order to do that, she has in her possession a single qubit. And there's obviously a naive way of encoding a single bit of classical information in a qubit and transmitting it over to Bob. She just prepares the quantum state 0 or 1, sends it over to Bob, who can then measure in the 0-1 basis and determine which state she's in. Okay, that's easy. It's not so obvious how you would encode these two these four possibilities corresponding to two bits of classical information in the qubit, and get it over to Bob. Is that possible? Well, it's actually been known for about 30 odd years that in fact it's impossible. However, in 1992, Charles Bennett and Stephen Wiesner came up with a nice variant of this, which is very counterintuitive, in my opinion, known as superdense coding, which is almost as good. The idea is that Bob starts with two qubits in his possession, and he prepares them in some special quantum state. What he then does is he sends one of the qubits off to Alice. Alice then does some sort of manipulation to that qubit depending only on A and B. So she does it depending only on her knowledge of A and B. And then, once she's done that, she sends it back over to Bob, who tries to determine the value of A and B. And superdense coding is actually a protocol which allows this to be accomplished. And it's rather surprising, in my opinion, because, well, Alice has only ever been able to interact with one of the qubits, yet somehow she's managed to encode two bits of information onto it. Right, let me describe it in slightly more detail, exactly how this is done. I'm going to do it in the quantum circuit language. We've got Alice's part of the circuit is up here, Bob's is down here. You'll see that there's some communication done. And I'm going to break the circuit up into three parts. So I'm going to assume, as I said before, that we start out in the 0-0 state. And let's look first at this yellow part of the circuit diagram. I'm going to drop the ket notation simply because it gets rather irritating. There's quite a bit to go on this view graph. I'm also going to drop normalization factors of root 2. I hope that things remain clear. So let's see. We start out in the 0-0 state here. Then a Hadamard gate is applied to the first qubit. So you might recall that what a Hadamard gate is, it takes the state 0 into a equal superposition of 0 and 1, so 0 plus 1. And so the corresponding quantum state after applying the Hadamard gate is 0, 0 plus 1, 0. Then you apply the controlled not to each of these two terms. So the controlled not applied to 0, 0, well, the control bit is set to 0, so nothing happens to the target. We're left with 0, 0. If you apply the controlled not to the 1, 0 state, well, the control bit is set here, so the target gets flipped and we're left with 1, 1. And that's the state at the end of Bob's manipulation. So all that's happened here is Bob's kept control of the qubits and he's done some manipulations which result in this state being prepared, the 0, 0 plus 1, 1 state. Now, he sends the first qubit of this pair over to Alice. And Alice is going to perform some operations depending on the particular values for A and B which she has. Let me just mention what this notation up here means. It's pretty simple. All I mean is, for example, in this first gate here, if B is 0, if the bit B is 0, then Alice doesn't do anything here. She applies x to the 0th power, which is the identity operator. If B is set to 1, then she applies the x gate. And similarly for A over here and applying the z gate or not applying the z gate. So what happens? Well, there's obviously four possibilities to analyze. We're just going to go through one in detail. So at the start of the day, Alice has the first qubit of these two qubits in her possession, and Bob has the second, and she's going to do some manipulations. So let's go through one particular line of possibilities. The line I'm going to go through corresponds to the B equals 1 case, but you can easily check all four of them. So what happens when B equals 1? Well, we apply the X gate first. So this qubit gets flipped, 0 becomes a 1, and this qubit here also gets flipped and becomes a 0. And just for the sake of argument, I'm going to take the case when A equals 0, and in that case, nothing happens here, so we're left with 1, 0, plus 0, 1 at the end of the day. And in fact, we've got four separate states corresponding to the four different possibilities. Then Alice sends her qubit back to Bob. Bob now has possession of both the qubits. It's actually possible at this point to see the result of superdense coding. We don't need all this mess here at the end. The reason why, you might remember in the last lecture I talked about measuring in an orthonormal basis. Well, if you look at these four states long enough, you'll realize that in fact they're orthonormal to one another. So we can perform a measurement in that basis, and in fact, or Bob could in principle perform a measurement in that basis and determine which of these four states he had. Once he's determined which of those four states he has, he would know whether A, you know, the value of both A and B, and they'd be done. Of course, in the way I've described the quantum circuit model to you, I've said that we measure in the computational basis. We're not allowed to measure in an arbitrary orthonormal basis. So we actually need to do some unitary transformations to accomplish this, or some extra quantum logic gates. And we'll just work through this specific example where A equals 0 and B equals 1. In the purple section here at the end. So we've got the state 1, 0 plus 0, 1. That's in Bob's possession. He applies a controlled NOT gate. So 1, 0 becomes 1, 1, the target being flipped. 0, 1 remains 0, 1 because the control bit is not set. And then when you apply the Hadamard gate to the first qubit, do a little bit of algebra, you'll discover that the final state is 0, 1. And if Bob now performs a measurement in the computational basis, he'll read off the value 0 and 1, which of course corresponded to the particular value of A and B, which we chose going down the tree. And this is the case for all four possibilities. So this is how you would explain superdense coding in the quantum circuit model, although in principle we could say that we were done at this earlier stage. We knew that the measurement was possible in principle. So this is, you know, this is a good example of using quantum information, qubits, to do some type of information processing that would seem very counterintuitive from a classical viewpoint. Let me give you one other example of quantum information processing. This is a little bit closer to sort of algorithmic ideas. It's based on a problem which David Deutsch posed in his original paper about quantum computation, known as Deutsch's problem. I'll describe briefly to you what Deutsch's problem is. What we have, the scenario is that basically somebody's given you a black box which is capable of computing some function f. And f is a function which takes as input a single bit and produces as output a single bit. Now, our task, Deutsch's problem, is to determine whether f is constant or balanced. So f is either has the same value for the two bits, or else it has different values for the two bits, in which case we say it's a balanced function. Obviously, if we do this classically, then we need to evaluate both f of 0 and f of 1 to determine whether it's constant or balanced, and thus we must use our black box for evaluating f twice. Turns out, quantumly, Deutsch was able to show that in fact we only need to use the black box for f once in order to determine this. Actually, Deutsch's original algorithm was not quite this good. What I'm going to describe today is an improved version, which is due, I'm not sure I'll get it right. I know Richard Cleave and Elaine Tapp were both both involved, but several of the people in the audience were involved in the elaboration of Deutsch's algorithm. Okay, but the key point here is that there's some advantage to doing things quantumly. Now, this obviously doesn't look... first of all, it's a very artificial problem. Second of all, you know, it's not very impressive. What's interesting, however, is that the ideas introduced, in fact, to do this seem to be very general. There's a line of thought going from, certainly, the argument Deutsch used all the way up through to Shor's algorithm. It's a, you know, elaboration of an idea and improved and deepening understanding, as people will describe over the next couple of days, Peter and Peter Hoyer and Mike Mosca in particular. Let me describe what I mean by a black box in a little bit more detail. Now I'm going to adopt a particular model, what I mean by a black box. So let me describe what I mean by a classical black box, and I'll describe what I mean by a quantum black box. Basic idea is very simple. You have an input bit, X, and you have some other bit, which I'll call the answer bit, which will, I'll assume is in some state Z, 0 or 1. Then I apply the black box. It does nothing to the input bit X, and it just adds f of X to the output. So this is the particular model for the black box which I'm choosing. The quantum model I'm going to use is exactly the same, except bits are replaced by qubits. X gets taken to X, Z gets taken to Z plus f of X. And if you write down the corresponding unitary transformation, it's pretty easy to convince yourself that no matter what the function is, f is, this box would in fact be unitary, as required for a quantum gate. I'll explain a little bit later on how, given, you know, presumably the black box doing this operation, which we don't, we assume we don't know the internal workings of, it's just been given to us. Presumably there's some classical logical circuit which is being used, which is internal to this. I'm going to explain that that classical logical circuit could always be given an equivalent quantum implementation. And that's a useful sort of a construction. So these two really are, in some sense, equivalent to one another. Okay, let me describe to you how Deutsch, or how the modern version of Deutsch's algorithm, how it works. It's very, very... Oh, excuse me. I first of all need to introduce a nice little trick. The description I've given for the quantum black box on the previous view graph, I assumed that we started in a computational basis state Z for the answer qubit. What would happen if I applied this black box with the second qubit in a superposition state, 0 minus 1 over root 2? Well, I'll consider two cases. Case number 1 is when f of x is equal to 0. In that case, well, what happens is that I've omitted normalization factors here, is that f of x gets added to the second qubit, but f of x is equal to 0, so 0 is left alone and 1 is left alone, and in fact the entire state of the computer is left alone. In case when f of x is equal to 1, well, we add 1 to the second qubit, and therefore 0 becomes 1 and 1 becomes 0, and you can rewrite this final state as minus x times 0 minus 1. An easy way of summarizing this in the two cases is that regardless of the value of f, the original state x times 0 minus 1 gets taken to minus 1 to the power f of x times 0 minus 1. And just for notational convenience, I'm going to simplify this a little. You'll notice the state of the second qubit never changes. It's irrelevant, in fact. We may as well just throw it away from our description. We can sort of remember that it's there in the background, but it'll never play any important role. So when I want to write the action, I'm just going to write the effective action on the first qubit. You know, x gets changed to minus 1 to the power f of x times x. And sort of implicit in there is a 0 minus 1, which you can write in if you wish, but is not going to be important at all. Okay, so what we've done is we've encoded information about the function, or we've used this construction and one call to this black box to encode information about this function not in the actual value of the computational basis state, but rather in this factor out the front, which people often call a phase factor. That's why I've talked up here about putting information in the phase, putting information about the function in the phase. So, without further ado, we can give the quantum algorithm for solving Deutsch's problem. It's a very simple circuit indeed. What we have is two input qubits. I've disobeyed my own dictum earlier. I'm going to assume that the second qubit starts in this 0 minus 1 over root 2 state. Actually, if it didn't, you could easily, even if you assumed it started in the 0 state, you could very easily convert it into this. That's maybe an exercise for you. And then you simply apply this circuit. And notice, well, what I'm going to tell you is that by reading out this qubit, this top qubit, at the end of the day, you'll be able to determine whether the function was constant or balanced, but only using one application of the black box. So how does this work? Let's go through and just check everything. Again, I'm going to omit all the normalization factors. They're not going to be important. So the Hadamard gate, because this 0 minus 1 state never changes through the course of the algorithm, I'm going to omit it from all my description. I'm just going to write the state of the first qubit, as I described previously. So the Hadamard gate acting on the first qubit takes it from 0 to 0 plus 1, up to the normalization factors. Then we apply this black box. And remember, things act linearly in quantum mechanics, so we simply end up with minus 1 to the f of 0 in front of the 0 term, and minus 1 to the f of 1 in front of the 1 term. Then we apply our Hadamard gate again to the first qubit. 0 gets taken to the state 0 plus 1 by the Hadamard gate, and 1 gets taken to the state 0 minus 1 by the Hadamard gate. And we can collect like terms here. In particular, we'll collect the 0 terms and the 1 terms separately, and we end up with this expression. And that's the final state of this qubit. Now let's consider the different possible cases. So the first case is when f is constant. If f is constant, then this number here, minus 1 to the f of 0, must be the same as this number here, minus 1 to the f of 1. So these two terms cancel out. We're left with 0 there. And all of the amplitude for the state is concentrated in this first term. So if we were to perform a measurement, we'd get the result 0 with probability 1. It's the only possible measurement outcome. So if we perform a measurement at the end of the day and get the result 0, we know that f was constant. On the other hand, if f were balanced, then we would know that minus 1 to the f at 0 had the opposite sign to minus 1 to the power of f of 1, and therefore these two terms must cancel. So all the amplitude must be concentrated in front of the 1 state. And again, if we were to perform a measurement, we'd discover that the result was 1 with probability 1. So that's Deutsch's algorithm for determining whether the function is constant or balanced. I want to point out just a couple of little points about this algorithm, or how it works, or why it works, or people's intuition about why it works. There's a notion known as quantum parallelism that will reappear a lot over the next couple of days. It seems to be key for a whole bundle of quantum algorithms. In this particular context, what quantum parallelism refers to is really this step here. We go to this superposition of the two possible values of the bit, 0 plus 1, and then with a single application of this black box for F, we're able to obtain or encode in our quantum state information about the value of the function for a whole bundle of different possible inputs. In fact, by using more sophisticated versions of the same idea for a system of n qubits, you can, with a single application of such a black box, obtain information about an enormous number of different values of the function, or encoded in some sense in the quantum state. So there's some information in here about both f of 0 and f of 1, despite the fact that you've only evaluated the function once. Now, you're not able to obtain the information exactly. You can't just read it out. That's a terrible pity. It'd be lovely if you could read it out. You could, you'd be able to determine everything about f of 0 and f of 1. But you can't do that in any easy fashion. What you instead need to do is something rather more complicated. Down here we arranged this sort of cancellation of terms so that what you do, physicists call this interference, where you get this type of cancellation of terms, and you seem to have to arrange just the right sort of interference so that you can obtain the sort of global information about the function that you desire, in this particular case, whether it's constant or balanced. And using these two ideas in parallel, in sequence, the notion of quantum parallelism followed by some sort of interference to obtain global information about the function seems to be the way in which all quantum algorithms thus far known work. It's perhaps worth mentioning something I saw occur a few years ago in Torino, 1997. There was a big workshop on quantum computation in Torino, and I believe it was Richard Josa got up and gave a talk, he just made a few remarks at the beginning about, you know, what he thought was the source of a quantum computer's power or apparent power. And you should have seen the room explode after about 10 or 15 minutes. Somebody, I think, just finally burst out, couldn't help themselves. You know, you're wrong. You know, the real reason for a quantum computer's power is da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I don't think Richard really spoke very much for about the next hour and a half, but a lot of other people did at great length. There were Peter Shaw, Umesh Vasirani, Charles Bennett, many other people who've contributed to the study of quantum algorithms were there, and they, you know, everybody seemed to have their own ideas about what makes quantum computers powerful. So I think it's fair to say that even though we have these kind of heuristics involving quantum parallelism and interference and whatnot, nobody really has a very good feeling for what the source of a quantum computer's power is. It's a very interesting question about which, having a desire to finish my talks, I won't speculate further.